Bonjour à tous. Good morning, everybody. First of all, I would like to welcome all of you for coming and participating into this meeting. And especially our colleagues coming from abroad, sometime from very far away. It's very nice to have all of you here. Before we start with this the scientific part of this meeting, I would like to introduce why this meeting is taking place and a few concepts that I think will be discussed today and tomorrow. So this symposium is a part of a teaching that started to develop last fall. And last fall, we had a series of lectures around the question of life history and energetic constraints in hominin evolution. And the use at the Collège de France is after these lectures to have guests. So there can be guests coming after each lecture in a seminar, or it can take place in the form of a symposium. It's the first time that we use this format for my chair. So I selected a couple of slides, pictures, that I presented during my teaching just to refresh those who were at my lessons, and also to explain to those who did not attend my course what we are talking about in this symposium. So we're talking about the economy of energy, and the economy of energy is something very important for all organisms, not just humans. Energy is extracted from the environment, and of course the capability of organisms to extract energy from the environment widely depends on the environment. So the ecology is an important factor, and very different environments have different carrying capacity. And so that's the first step of this economy. This energy that is extracted, a part of it is stored as a buffer for bad conditions, and mostly in mammals like us, it's fat. And then this energy is used for different functions. And so there is a budget of energy in living organisms, and life history is all about how energy is dispatched in this budget, so where you invest more or less. The first thing we have to invest in is growth and development. So from the time we are just one egg, we have to grow up and become an adult able to reproduce. And so there is a big investment in growth. And later, when growth is achieved, this energy is going to be used on the one hand for maintenance. So the organism has to be functional and to be maintained, and this includes many aspects of the metabolism and the defense of the organism and the repair of DNA and things like that. And so, assuming that we are more or less in healthy condition, we can also invest some of our energy in reproduction. And reproduction, sex, it's a very costly activity in many aspects. And eventually, this is how we can pass our DNA on the next generation. And of course, in the course of all this process, we have also physical activities, especially locomotion, which is one of the main activity of mammals like us. And so what we're interested in this meeting is to understand how all these different budgets are managed in a successful way. And if we look at what what happens in the rest of the living world, we see that there are many different ways to budget energy. So there are some creatures that invest a lot, for example, in reproduction and fecundity, and they have a short lifetime. And some others, they invest more, for example, on longevity or on their activities, but they have a reduced fecundity. So basically, there is a trade-off between all these different investments in energy, and there are different kinds of solutions. So in theory, what you gain on something, you lose it on something else. But this being said, there are some species that are doing very well, and the question that we addressed during my teaching at some point was, how come the owners of luxury cars manage to also have luxury houses? And I would say in the living world, probably hominins are some of the creatures that do the best in winning on many aspects of this energy budget. And this is going to be central to our discussion today and tomorrow. And if we look quickly at different aspects of hominin biology, we can see that somehow we can be sorted with this kind of wealthy creatures that have luxury cars and nice houses. And of course, it has a lot to do with the capability of hominins to have to develop technology and to also develop social complexity. That's it's a main way to address some of the challenges of this energy budgeting. So to start with, and we discussed that, hominins, in general, hominins are compared to other hominoids or species that are costly in the sense that they extract a lot of energy from their environment. They have a high metabolism, and they have also a lot of energy expenditure daily. So from this point of view, yes, they are very, I would say, wealthy. The way they use this energy especially in the growth and development, is widely related to the fact that when compared to other monkeys and apes, here it's a chart showing the relationship between body weight and brain weight in old world monkeys and apes. Hominins are different from others by the fact that they have a much larger brain in relation to their body weight. So they are out of this regression line, which is, of course, it's in a log-log scale. So this brain, that is only 2% of the body weight, of the, yes, body size, it's very costly in terms of energy. And when you are sitting here not doing much, your brain is basically burning 20% of your breakfast. I hope it burns even a little bit more, because you're listening to me and trying to figure out what we are going to do today. And this situation, which is very peculiar to humans, have led to a lot of speculations about how humans manage to invest all this energy in their brain. About 20 years ago, a bit more, there was a paper published by our colleagues, Leslie Aiello and Wheeler, that developed a concept that became popular under the term of the expansive tissue hypothesis. And it's the notion that, in fact, the way humans manage to invest so much in their brain is because they reallocated energy saved on other organs, and in particular the gut, so the digestive system. So the general idea that these authors developed is that basically humans have a much bigger brain that is expected for a primate of their body size, but in the meantime they have a smaller gut than what is expected. And as the gut is also a rather costly organ, the idea is that we shifted from a mostly vegetarian diet to a diet that is more carnivorous. And by doing that, we could reduce the size of our gut, have a high energy diet with a high amount of energy, and we reallocate the saved energy and the acquired energy to the brain. So this concept was very discussed, and in the following years there was a number of discussion and critics about this expansive tissue hypothesis. And through the year, people have developed concepts which are more, I would say, complex, sophisticated than the expansive tissue hypothesis, with the notion that, in fact, humans manage to have a larger brain, of course, by increasing the amount of energy they extract from the environment, and by reallocating energy from one organ or one function to another. But this is much more complex than just reducing the gut and increasing the brain. So in other words, in terms of increasing the input of energy, there are different strategies that has been followed by hominins. And you'll see that in the course of the discussion today and tomorrow, that this is not just about diet or just about biology, but there is a lot of aspects related to the behavior, especially when it relates to reproduction and the care we can give to our offsprings. And regarding the reallocation of energy, yes, there is this aspects related to diet, but there are other aspects of the hominin biology that have been the field of reductions, reallocations. We discussed, for example, the muscular system and how it's different from what we see in apes. So some of the questions that we have to discuss here is the comparison of the locomotion costs, the growth, the development between humans and non-humans primates. In particular, reproduction, it's a very interesting topic in this perspective. Although humans start to reproduce later than apes like chimpanzees or gorillas, they are able to produce quite a number of offspring. This is the curve of fecundity compared between female chimpanzees, wild chimpanzees, and human women from traditional societies. Women are in white and chimpanzees are in black. And what you see that is that although the time for menopause is about the same in the two species, there is a very high fecundity of women, especially in their younger adult age. And at the end of the story, a woman can produce as much or even more offspring than a female chimpanzee, especially if the survival of this offspring is taken into consideration. One of the reasons why this is possible is that, I would say, again, in traditional societies, you commonly have situations like that, which is a situation where one female have several children of different ages that she's able to raise simultaneously. And this is possible primarily for two reasons. First of all, these babies are weaned much earlier than in other apes. And most importantly, all these guys there in the background, after the weaning is accomplished, are able to contribute to the growth and development, especially the brain development of these children. And this is a situation that you don't see mostly in other primates, especially in apes. Another question that's very peculiar, and that we have another feature that's very peculiar and we'll have to discuss in this meeting, is the question of locomotion. And this is another big difference between humans and apes. As you know, of course, we are bipedal, we are able to walk, we are able, importantly, we are also able to run. And in the past years, there was a number of studies investigating these aspects of human biology with a lot of experiments. Trying to figure out what is peculiar in terms of energy cost, not just with the walk, but with especially the question of running, and how humans compare to other quadrupedal mammals or apes in this respect. And the reason why, beside the issue of energy cost, the reason why we are so interested in the question of running is because we think that running is something that is related to something else which is very peculiar of humans, which is their ability to hunt and the fact that they are a predatory species of large primates. By the way, predation is going to be the topic of my next cycle of lectures this fall. So for those who are interested in predation, it's time to come in late October to learn more about these different aspects of predation in ancient humans. And so when we look to the past, and we look at archaeological sites, this is one site that we excavated years ago with my colleagues, including William Rondu and Shannon McFerrin, who are in the list of participants. It's a Mousterian site from southwestern France, and this site is a huge accumulation of reindeer bones, and gives us the picture of this hypercarnivore, maybe hypercarnivore Neanderthals, with a lot of questions about whether they are really hypercarnivores, top carnivores or not, what is the spectrum of diet they really have. But the fact is that, yes, they hunt quite a lot of animals, so they obtain this very rich diet, which is maybe complemented with other things, and Amanda Henry have worked a lot on the vegetal side of the Neanderthal diet. And this meat, this fat that's obtained by hunting, it's prepared. And food treatment, food preparation, it's also another big issue in all these questions about energy, because especially by cooking and preparing food, we are able to facilitate digestion, to extract a higher amount of calories from a given amount of food, especially meat. And there have been a lot of works and discussions in the past few years regarding the question of development of the fire use, development of cooking, the question of whether there was not other ways to deal with meat and food to facilitate ingestion, digestion, to increase the amount of calories, grinding, pounding, things like that, maybe eating food that has been rotting for a while and all sorts of things like that. John Spett wrote a very interesting paper about this issue in the journal Paleanthropology, and this will be part of the topics we'll discuss tomorrow, keeping in mind the fact that in all this, the development of all these behaviors, predation, food acquisition, food preparation, is not just about increasing the amount of energy, there is also a price to pay for that. So in other words, cooking, it's very nice if you have a microwave in your kitchen and you just have to push on a button. But now if you have to walk around in the landscape to gather wood, the question becomes, what is most advantageous, to spend a lot of energy to make a fire, and then you can extract more calories from your food, or just eat your food raw and not to mind too much about the fact that you could have more calories, but you rest quietly at home and you don't have to work a lot to and spend calories to find the wood. So this is a very sort of short visit of the questions that we have discussed in the lessons. And to go deeper in all these issues, I've invited colleagues that I think are the best specialists of all these questions, and they have been very nice to accept my invitation, and they are here for 2 days to go deeper in all these issues. So you have this program in hand. Unfortunately, one of the participants, who is Will Rebrooks, who are supposed to speak this afternoon, is too ill to come, and had to the last minute to cancel his coming. But there will be at least two other colleagues to speak a lot about fire. Maybe I'll try to voice the opinion of Will, because I don't want him to be contradicted too much by opponents when he's not here. No, but in the end, I think we'll find a compromise and an agreement on all these questions. So the meeting is going to last a day and a half. I would say it's a relaxed meeting. Well, it's so relaxed that the administrator forgot to come this morning. And what I mean is that we are having time for each speaker. We have half an hour. And it does not mean, of course, that each speaker is going to speak half an hour, but the idea is that each presentation will be 20 minutes. And I asked the speakers to try to really stick with this format. And then there will be a chairman, this morning Shannon McFerran, this afternoon Philip Gunz, and tomorrow Amanda Henry, that will take the microphone from the speakers after 20 minutes first, and also that will give the speech to the audience to ask questions. So questions by the participants to the symposium, and questions by the public in general. So I think I said about everything I wanted about this all this presentation. I ask you to stop your cell phone or to put them on the mute position if you did not. Do yet, and do it yet if you did not do it yet, and I think we can start. So Shannon.